Okay, everybody knows by now that that means it's time for our little fireside chats once again. This is your host speaking after having played one of my favorite ZZ Top songs that's sort of the reflection of the theme, as always, of this podcast, which is the third part of the substance use, abuse, and dependency disorders, typically known as quote-unquote addictions in the lay population. So if you haven't heard the previous two podcasts, I strongly recommend you listen to those before continuing on to this one, because I'm going to assume that you've had the information I presented at the first two and that this is just sort of the follow-up continuation. So, to remind everyone, from our last episode, we were talking about what addictions really are and what they are not. And I gave you folks some references to look at, one of being Herbert Fingeret's landmark book, Heavy Drinking, The Myth of Alcoholism as a Disease. And as you know by now, if you've been listening to this podcast, I am about as far from the disease slash 12-step model as one could possibly get. Certainly, as I mentioned earlier, there are some things that the disease model advocates that in terms of treatment and in terms of what I would call good common sense behavioral management stuff that I would certainly subscribe to, abstinence being one of them, particularly if you have some comorbid conditions, other psychological conditions with the addictive component. And particularly if you've had prior attempts to curtail or cut down or stop use, research is pretty clear that there's a substantial number of folks who once had a substance abuse slash and or dependency problem who can go back to casual use without becoming so-called quote-unquote relapse into full addiction, contrary to the popular myth of the disease model. However, there's a whole lot of people who cannot, and my advice to everyone is don't tempt fate. You don't need them to live. It's like having optional surgery, and the guy says, well, I can make your nose job look fabulous, or you can go under the knife and stand about a 53% chance of dying. No, I don't think so. And that's about the rate of folks who can't go back and use again. So while I certainly will take whatever I can get, so to speak, in terms of cutting down or stopping completely, my clear advice to folks, particularly with the comorbid conditions, and the more of those that you have, the more likely it is you're not going to be able to cut down and just use casually. So my advice to everybody across the board just about is abstinence is your best model. Now, I've talked about a lot of comorbid disorders before. Let me reiterate what those are. Typically, you'll see learning disorders typically accompany the substance use dependency disorders, which I'm including in that the communication disorders along with those. And depending on what studies you look at, variance is somewhere between about 15% and 25% comorbidity. ADHD is a lot higher. Attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, that has a huge high comorbidity with addictive disorders, particularly if you have conduct disorder, which also has, by the way, a high comorbid rate, somewhere between 50% and 20% with substance abuse and dependency disorders. And the study I saw several years ago said that if you were an ADHD male because we don't have quite enough data for females to make these sweeping generalizations with females, because as most of you know, ADHD has heretofore been predominantly and still is predominantly a male disorder. So if you're an ADHD male, you have a 63% chance of having either conduct disorder or oppositional defiant disorder, which is a lesser version of conduct disorder, so to speak, less severity. And that also has a high comorbidity with addictive disorders also, by the way, shock, shock. So, but if you're an ADHD male, you have about a 63% chance of having oppositional defiant or conduct disorder. And if you are a conduct disordered or oppositional defiant disordered ADHD male, you have a 90%+ chance of having a substance use and or dependency disorder. So this is why I say, yeah, don't tempt fate, guys and gals. Don't be stupid, okay? Major depressive disorders have a pretty high comorbidity rate, about 70%. Those include major depression and include also dysthymic disorder, which is, as I mentioned before, sort of a wimpier version of the depression, major depression disorder, more lower level. It's not less serious. I don't mean to imply that, but it's a lower level that doesn't quite meet the depression criteria. Anxiety disorders have a pretty high comorbidity. Post-traumatic stress disorder has about a 40% rate with substance abuse and dependency. Generalized anxiety is about 12%. Higher rate, by the way, if you're a female. It's one of the few times when women outnumber guys. So when women say guys are generally more foobarred than women, that's not a sexist comment. That's a reality comment. if you look at the percentages, most males outnumber females. Where there's a gender discrepancy in your psych disorders, males outnumber females more often than females outnumber males. And it's a pretty substantial number, percentages. As most of you know, obsessive-compulsive disorder, which is also an anxiety disorder, falls under this rubric, and it also has a comorbidity. It's part of the anxiety cluster. Bipolar disorder, which is a mood disorder characterized by swings between high, quote-unquote, high states, manic-y type states. It can also be hypomanic, which is kind of a lesser form of mania. So you cycle between that and being depressed or slash dysthymic. I want to point out that this is usually a weeks to months scenario. So if you've got somebody who's rapid cycling, quote unquote, that just means they're cycling, you know, between weeks as opposed to months. If you've got somebody who's cycling in the same day, that's not bipolar disorder. They've been, in all likelihood, they've been misdiagnosed, and they're probably a borderline personality disorder person, since they tend to be very excitable, as Warren Zevon might say, excitable boy, they all said, or in the borderlines case, since women, another one where women outnumber men greatly, excitable gal, they all said, or they could have histrionic personality disorder, and those are often misperceived as bipolars if the evaluation isn't done correctly. I can't tell you how many jillions of those I've seen. It's really annoying, but at any rate, bipolar has a crossover comorbidity with addictive disorders as well. Eating disorders, which include both anorexia nervosa, which is the, not going to maintain body weight, not going to eat kind of thing, or bulimia nervosa, which is the, purging dilly. Those disorders have somewhere between a 10 and 15% rate with substance abuse and dependency disorders. Personality disorders, which I mentioned earlier, the borderline, personality disorders definitely have a high comorbidity rate with addictive disorders, somewhere between 40 and 70%, particularly the cluster B personality disorders. So for those of you who don't know, the DSM has subdivided personality disorders into three classes or categories, and I'm not quite sure how they came up with these, but they're classified according to similar cluster of behaviors that are commonplace amongst them. So they're classified according to whether they fall under cluster A, cluster B, or cluster C, kind of like going to an Asian restaurant. I'll take one from column A, one from column B. the cluster A personality disorders, and this is how I get my undergrad and grad students to remember this fact. Cluster A, I jokingly name the aliens because all the personality disorders that fall into cluster A all have some form of odd or eccentric type behaviors. You know, I joke about, you know, imagine a group of personality disorders, you know, that sort of look kind of schizzy-esque, you know, and these are your paranoid personality disorders, which is not the same thing as paranoid disorder, which has been renamed in DSM-4, delusional disorder, schizoid personality disorder, and schizotypal personality disorder. And again, those are not to be confused with schizophrenia, which is a psychotic disorder. So these folks aren't crazy. They're not, you know, totally out in la-la land, but they're certainly kind of funky and odd or eccentric. The persons in the cluster B personality disorder, I jokingly refer to cluster Bs as Bayat and Kai. These are the folks that you would least likely to befriend or to be dating or to meet on a dark alley coming out of the Fox Theater heading for your car after a show. these are, with the exception of those being the histrionic personality disorders, they're fairly innocuous. They're just annoying as heck because they're dramatic. In fact, all of the cluster B personality disorders, the common cluster is they're very, very over the top, very uber emotional, very erratic and or dramatic type behaviors. Histrionic falls under the cluster Bs, and the other ones that are really the guys and gals you definitely don't want to hang out with on a very commonplace basis are the narcissistic personality disorders, as one of my friends once described those folks, a legend in their own mind, and or folks who thought they were hot shit and they weren't even warm diarrhea. You gotta love that. And sorry if my language has offended anybody, but I did warn you on the outset of this if you read the disclaimer to my site, so don't be shocked. So those are the narcissists. Then you have the antisocials. These are the folks that you definitely don't want to get close to. These are folks who have basically no conscience. And you don't have to be a murderer to be an antisocial. You just have to cross major boundary transgressions and break major rules of society on a pretty frequent basis and have like zero conscience about it. And there are quite a number of famous politicians I could name, but won't for obvious reasons, who clearly fall under that rubric. And the the borderlines, the borderline personality disordered folks, who are the folks that have extremely shifting moods and who one minute will love you to death and literally 5 minutes later you're Satan's handmaiden. They do what psychoanalysts used to call splitting the all good, all bad, and these folks are highly erratic and can be potentially dangerous. In terms of assaulting you and chasing around the house with a frying pan and all kinds of stuff. And I'm not joking. I've had cases where that's been the case. So these are folks you don't want to hang out with on a regular basis. And the other clusters are the cluster C personality disorders. And I jokingly refer to these as your cowards. The C stands for cowards. And I say that with full and total unashamedness, because my own personality disorder falls under the cluster C. So I'm not slamming anybody, and if I am, I'm slamming myself, okay? So under the cluster C personality disorders belong the dependent personality disorders, the avoidant personality disorders, and the obsessive compulsive personality disorder, my personal favorite, and the one from which I proudly suffer. Thank you very much. And this is not to be confused, by the way, with OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. That's an anxiety disorder. These are two very different disorders. But all of the cluster C personality disorders are folks who base their interactions with themselves and with the world around anxiety-based or fear-based, irrational fear-based, I might add, for the most part, waiting for the other shoe to fall kinds of belief systems. So somebody, for those of you who don't know the difference, I can give you a really common place example, and I think you'll get it. If any of you folks are familiar with the movie As Good As It Gets, for example, Jack Nicholson's character is full-blown obsessive-compulsive. That's OCD, the hand-washing and all, you know, throwing the soap away kind of thing after washing your hands one time. Or those of you who are familiar with Tony Shalhoub's character, Monk, on the TV show, that guy has full-blown obsessive-compulsive disorder. If any of you have seen some of the old reruns of The Odd Couple, the Felix Unger, the kind of compulsive-y, nervous kind of guy, he's also pretty histrionic and has hypochondriasis. He always thinks something's wrong with him and all that stuff, but he is OCPD. He's a neat freak. He drives everybody crazy, very orderly behavior, that sort of thing. So the obsessive compulsives have rituals, and they have to do them to avert some horrible thing happening. And if you ask them what that horrible thing is, they can't tell you, but ooh, it's going to be bad. So these are the guys and gals that hand wash and count and wear gloves when they shake hands with other people and have a germ phobia, that kind of stuff. It's a much more serious disorder than OCPD. The other sort of tweaky difference between the two is the OCD people, for the most part, find the disorder pretty annoying. It's the term is ego dystonic, which means it doesn't match. It's sort of dissonant with their own wishes. You know, these are the guys and gals that spend 8 hours, you know, scrubbing the floor and find a spot on the floor and have to scrub the whole floor again kind of thing. They have to start this ritual over. The OCPD people don't have that, and they can sometimes control their thoughts and their rumination-type behaviors and compulsive-type behaviors. And for most OCPD people, and this definitely includes myself for the most part, their disorder is ego-syntonic, which means they like it and wish the whole heck world had it and believe that the world would be a much better place if everybody had it. And I would be in complete and total agreement with that, actually. Oops, did I say that? I often joke with my folks that I work with that when you look up OCPD in the DSM, my picture is there with a big grin on my face going, why, yes, I am, and why isn't everybody? So it's the kind of thing that if you use it correctly, you can really accomplish a lot of stuff. But if you don't use it correctly and if you don't monitor the heck out of it, it ends up biting you in the patooties big time and driving everybody else around you nuts. Which kind of goes back to my statement I made on the last podcast about reclaiming your power. You know, one of the problems I have with the 12 steps is a sense of powerlessness and oh, you can't help it and you have a disease and read my tongue. Right? That you've given up your power. You've chosen to give up your power. Okay? So I tell people, get the power back. But in order to claim the power, it requires that nasty four-letter word, probably the most obscene four-letter word in the English language, bar none. And if you don't know what it is, I'm about to tell you, so if you're easily offended, you may want to run away or hold your ears during this part of the conversation. But the word is not what you think it is. The word is work. Okay, W-O-R-K, that horribly obscene word never to be spoken in the annals of history. So if you want to reclaim your power and you want to take charge of your pathology, whether you have substance abuse dependency disorders or whether you have OCPD as I do, it requires work. Well, welcome to reality, friends and neighbors. So does losing weight, despite those ridiculous commercials you see on late night TV about, yes, I could take this pill and I could eat 4,000 donuts and 500 double cheeseburgers and I didn't gain a pound. You're right. And if you believe that stuff, I got a bridge in the Sahara I'll sell you really, really cheaply. Call my office and give me your credit card numbers. I've got a great bridge for you, okay? Anything really worth having in life requires effort and a boatload of it, whether it's learning to play guitar like Andres Segovia or Eddie Van Halen or Eric Clapton, or whether it's learning to be a great basketball player or a great rapper or a great athlete or speaker or parent or teacher or any daggum thing else. It requires that nasty four-letter word work. And believe you me when I tell you that the hardest work any of us will ever do is getting a hold of ourselves, or as I like to jokingly call it, putting a lid on our id. It's pretty daggum annoying, and it's a boatload of work. From my own personal perspective, I think it is incredibly worth it, because without that work, you cannot claim your power. And if you don't claim your power, something or somebody else is going to do it for you. And if you don't take the responsibility along with the power, with that work, that means you're going to be at the whim of society, your impulses, your disorders, whatever. And that's not a good thing, in my personal opinion. So a lot of what I do when I work with folks is teach them to reclaim their personal power and how to go about doing it. But it is a boatload of work, and I'm not going to kid you. You know, well, guess what? If you want to learn to swim in the Olympics, that's a boatload of work too, and you can't take any shortcuts. That stuff requires, again, that nasty four-letter word. Well, getting a handle on yourself, being aware of your problems, admitting your problems, and doing something about it takes more work than probably anything you will ever do in your life. Trust me on this one, guys and gals. But I absolutely believe that it is completely and totally worth it. And it's not something that you have to have a boatload of money to do or an overabundance of IQ points, okay? I tell everybody I interact with, everybody that I work with, that you really only need six things to make a meaningful change, and that means quitting using drugs, getting on a diet exercise plan, whatever, okay? And here are the six things. This is not magic. It's not secret. You know, it's you don't need a special handshake or an initiation to a club for this, okay? Here they are. You heard them here first. All right, and to think people pay me good money for this crap when they come in to see me. Okay, so number one, you have to have the ability to change, okay? That's not usually something that most people have a lack of, okay? Now, unless you have a 45 IQ and you're trying to go to college to be, you know, a gynecologist, that's probably not going to happen. You probably don't have the ability, okay? But most of the folks I see in my practice and most of the folks that I work with and counsel with or do consultation with or whatever, they have the ability to change, okay? So they have criteria one down. Criteria two, awareness. You got to recognize that you have a need for change. And somebody else can't recognize it for you and say, dude, you need to quit eating. Go away from the food bar, you know. You've got to come to that awareness yourself. You've got to accept the awareness yourself, okay? You've got to accept that you have a need to change, right? Which leads into point number three, which is you got to want to do it. You got to be motivated. Point number three is the motivation, the desire. You've got to want to do it. And I'm telling you, you got to want to do it a whole lot more than you want to remain sick and dependent on drugs or dependent on food or dependent on somebody else for your self-esteem. Because if you're dependent on somebody else for stuff, you don't have anything to do with yourself. You have what I call other, fill in the blank, other esteem, you know, other dependency, whatever, but you're not dependent on yourself. You have no self-esteem or self-dependency whatsoever. Don't kid yourself. Okay, so ability, awareness, and motivation. Number four, you have to have this term called self-efficacy, okay? Now, you're probably saying, what the heck is that? Okay, self-efficacy is an internal belief system that a person has whereby that person says, you know, I believe that I have what it takes to do whatever, learn to drive, learn to be a better, you know, sex partner, whatever, learn to play guitar, learn to stop using drugs, learn to make better grades in school, learn to quit being a pain in the butt to my parents or my wife or whatever, right? So self-efficacy means you believe that you can do it, believe that you have the internal equipment to do it. And again, somebody else can't tell you you can do it, because I'm sure you guys have, and gals have heard 100,000 times in your life about different areas. Oh, it's no big deal. I know you can do it. You're a smart guy. You're a smart gal. You're a nice person. You can do it. Oh, yeah, right? Well, doesn't matter what other people believe. It really only matters what you believe. Do you believe it? Right? Because you're not going to see it until you believe it. You're not going to be able to do it until you believe it. When I work with sports teams or individual athletes, you know, I tell them, if you go out on the field, you're about to play the game of your life, you're about to play a football match of your life, and you walk out on the field and you see, you know, the last year's champions 10 years in a row coming out on the field, and you say to yourself, oh my God, it's these guys, oh shit, we're never going to go back to the showers, you've already lost. you're done. The game's over. I know they haven't started, but the game's over. You're done. Okay? You have really got to believe it, right? I'll give you an even better example, and I was like jumping up and down shouting in the theaters when I first saw this as a kid. I went and saw, I'm a big Star Wars freak, and I'm a big movie freak anyway, but I like movies because they have messages for living in them, and sometimes they're real subtle and you have to hunt for them, but there's a scene in the second Star Wars in the series, second as they were published, not second in the chain, but second as they were published, where Luke is going to find Yoda, and Yoda's going to train him to be a Jedi Knight. And he finds Yoda, and Yoda's training him in the swamp of Dagobah, and he's trying to get him to lift this fighter plane that is semi-submerged in the swamp water. And this is right after he's been teaching Luke to lift rocks with his mind using the Force and all that kind of stuff. I'm sure you guys remember this, right? But those of you who don't, I'm just giving you a little nudge here. So if you remember the scene, you know, Luke says to Yoda, "Oh, this is not like lifting rocks." And Yoda says, "No, it's exactly like lifting rocks. There's no difference, okay? It's using your mind and getting in touch with the Force and using it for your purposes." So Luke goes, he goes, "Okay, right, I'm going to try," right? And what's Yoda's response? "There is no try, do or do not." Okay, that's the other line I like to use with my people. Right? So obviously Luke is missing a little self-efficacy here. Okay, so then he goes in and he tries to lift the X-Wing fighter, and he looks like he's going to lift it, and then he can't, and it drops in the water, right? And he turns to Yoda and says, "Master, you asked the impossible." And he goes off and kind of sulks, and and Yoda kind of rolls his eyes and goes over there and lifts the fighter up and sticks it by Luke. And Luke walks over to Yoda and says, "I don't believe it." And what's Yoda's reply? "And that is why you fail." That is self-efficacy, or the lack thereof in Luke's case. That's what I'm talking about. You've got to know it. You've got to believe it in your heart of hearts. That's what self-efficacy is. Number five, information. You got to know how to change. Somebody's got to teach you, right? Because you can have all the potential ability in the world. You can be aware that you want to change. You could be motivated, and you could even believe that you can do it. But you got to know how to do it, right? And this is really where I come in. I'm a teacher, and I tell most of the people who work with me, I'm basically an overpaid coach / teacher. I'm disseminating information, and kind of like I'm doing on these podcasts, right? I'm disseminating information, right? But if somebody takes the information and uses it or not, that is completely up to them. It's completely on them. It is completely their responsibility, which means if they screw up and they don't do what I tell them to do, they don't have anybody to look at in the mirror except themselves. Consequently, likewise, if they succeed, if they do what I ask them to do and they work with me and they get better and they conquer whatever it is they're trying to work on, don't look to me. It's not up to me. It's not, don't thank me. I didn't do a damn thing for you except give you the information and maybe kick you in the butt a couple of times or, cheer for you in the corner. And I look pretty ridiculous in a skirt and pom-poms, let me tell you. But I'm as big a cheerleader as anybody for somebody when they're trying their damnedest. And I will do whatever I can do to encourage you to do it. But you got to do the work. And you got to act like you're doing the work, and you got to prove to me you're doing the work, because I'm not exerting a boatload of effort so you can sit back and eat bonbons and go, "Let me know when I've gotten over this addiction problem," right? Or "Let me know when I've gotten over this attitude issue," all right? So I'm really an information giver. That's what I do. And so if somebody takes information and does wonderful things with it, then kudos to them. They do not owe me any thanks at all, except as the disseminator of information. I didn't change them. I can't change them. In fact, if I could change people, I'd be making a whole lot more money than I am now, and people would be coming to see me, and I'd probably be on a mountaintop in Tibet someplace going, "Om, oh, I'm telling you what, I'm going to be healing everybody," right? And we all know that's not the case. And if you don't know, I just told you, okay? So trust me on this one. I'm not God. I may kind of look like Jesus with the hair sometimes, right? But I'm not God or Jesus or any reasonable facsimile thereof, okay? I'm simply a teacher. That's really all I am. So I can't change anybody. And in fact, none of us can change anybody except ourselves. And that's really what this is about. This is about taking ownership of ourselves, regardless of what our issue is or issues are. That's really what this is about, right? Now, through no fault of our own, some of us come out of the chute with some default biochemistry, okay? So some people's, you know, neuronal synapses aren't firing really, really well through no fault of their own. They didn't, you know, bang their head in a rock concert against a concrete stage and do brain damage, or they didn't, you know, eat massive amounts of mushrooms at a, you know, a Grateful Dead concert or something. I mean, these are people who came out of the chute with, you know, some kind of defective neurochemistry, some kind of biochemistry was, you know, not done correctly. Mother Nature was asleep, okay? And there are folks for whom that is clearly the case. But I still tell those people, you're not responsible for the hand you were dealt, but you are responsible to take the hand you were dealt and play the best game of canasta you can with it, or best game of bridge or poker or whatever your deal is, right? That is on you. It's not on God, the force, disease, your parents, or any damn thing else. It's up to you to fix it or to live as effectively as you possibly can with it. That is your responsibility. And unless you take it, you're never really going to be well. I mean, that's the bottom line. And that's why this is so much doggone work. Okay? And number six is, once you have the ability, you have the awareness you need to change, you're motivated as heck to change, you really believe that you can do it, and you come to somebody like me, or you read a couple of books or whatever, and you get all the information you need, then you gotta do the last part, number six, which is practice, practice, practice. Kind of like the old joke about, the violinist walking the streets in New York City looking for Carnegie Hall, and he stops another guy carrying a violin case, and he figures he's a violin player, and he says, "Excuse me, can you tell me how to get to Carnegie Hall?" And the guy says, "Practice, practice, practice." Ba-doom, right? True story about a joke. I'm sure most of you have heard of that 1,000 times. If you haven't, well, now you have a new joke to add to your little arsenal, and God knows my jokes stink for the most part, but, you know, that's not one of mine. So I don't claim it. I'm just repeating it. But the message is very, very clear. It is practice, 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 and more practice till you're so daggum sick of it you could puke, okay? And that's really what this involves, practicing the lessons. And they're hard, because remember I talked about in the last podcast this thing called classical conditioning, right, and learning. You know, also another name for conditioning is learning. I think I mentioned that, right? So this, when you learn to use drugs for whatever, you're using them to moderate your mood, you're using them to change your mood, you know, better living through chemistry. You know, you use them so you won't feel like dog crap about the fact that you have ADHD, or that you wrecked your dad's car, or you cheated on your wife, or whatever, okay? When you get into the habit of doing something, then it becomes quote-unquote automatic. There really is no such thing as automatic behavior, except maybe breathing and heart pumping and blood flowing, right? All things that are seemingly automatic are simply extremely well overlearned, overpracticed behaviors that you've gotten really good at doing. And because they've gotten habitual, quote-unquote, that means you practice the heck out of them. You've overpracticed them to the point where they're almost unconscious, right? Then they become very, very, very difficult to moderate. So if you get in the habit of impulsively doing the first thing that comes to your head, or, you know, gratifying your id every single time you want to do it, you know, you feel nervous, you want to feel better right this minute, you can't wait 10 minutes to do a meditation exercise that I showed you, or that somebody else taught you, you read out of a book or whatever, but no, I'm going to do a quaalude and feel better right now. Well, if you get into the habit of doing that, that's pretty daggum rewarding for your body, because you get immediate results, right? Takes effort. Takes that, and we're back to that nasty four-letter word, right? Takes work to learn how to do meditation. It takes work to practice the meditation so that your body becomes used to doing it, so it becomes quote-unquote automatic, so that you can close your eyes, do an image, or say a few words to yourself and lower your blood pressure, boom, within 30 seconds. That takes work prior to getting to that point, okay? Because you're conditioning, you're training your body. Right. Well, if you train your body to go stick food in your mouth every time you feel upset, or, you know, stick a needle in your arm, or down a bottle of Jack Daniels, or whatever your thing is, go out sexing or texting or pornography or spending or buying or whatever the heck your deal, gambling, whatever your deal is, right, then that's what you're going to want to do. And then, of course, it's going to be foremost in your mind. You're going to start thinking about it over and over and over and over and over and over. That's called rumination. And you're going to feel pressured to act. And, oh, my God, and your blood pressure is going to be raising. Well, who's doing all that? You are. By thinking it. That's not the drug's responsibility. That's not the food's responsibility. That's not the hot chick or the, you know, the foxy guy's responsibility that you're thinking about, you know, having sexual relations with. That's not the pornography. I mean, that's you. Remember, everything is you. You can't do anything without a brain. The brain belongs and with you. It resides within you. Your thoughts are your own. You have to take charge of them. You have to become the master of yourself. And that is the hardest daggum thing any of us will ever do. Ever, 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 ever. And most of us never even get a tenth of what we're really capable of being that in that field. And I'm certainly no different in that regard. It's something that I work on every day. You know, and sometimes I do really, really well with it, and sometimes I fall on my patooties bigger than you know what. It's ridiculous, right? Because I was a human before I was a shrink, okay? So people go, oh, well, you've got all these high IQs and all these wars, and yeah, but you know what? I practiced being a weird guy way before I was a weird shrink or a weird musician or whatever, right? So I have just as much trouble with this as anybody else does. The only difference is, I'm pretty damn determined, you know, kind of like the line in the old John Cusack, you know, movie, call me Mr. Determined, you know, I pretty much never say die. It's like I joke with people, don't get between a crab and his meat, you know, I go after something, I'm like a crab going after meat, right? So that's the name of that tune, and I just got to have to laugh at myself sometimes. Because it also works against me if I start ruminating about something, right? It's hard for me to stop doing it. And if it's something that's not good for me, I have to do plans that I've put in motion. I have to practice skills I've learned already to try to not do it, right? And, you know, you heard me say try, and that's a bad word, and I'm the first to tell you that. You know, most of the time I'm successful, sometimes I'm not. And then I have to restrain from beating the crap out of myself, because that's the bad side of obsessive compulsive personality disorder. You tend to beat the crap out of yourself when you mess up, right? First of all, you have unrealistically high expectations of yourself, and then you beat the heck out of yourself when you don't meet them. Like, okay, genius, you should have figured this crap out first before you had these stupidly high expectations. But would that change me? No, of course not. Why should that stop me, right? So, I mean, I deal with this stuff just like the rest of you people out there. And I have my foibles, and I have my, you know, so-called Achilles heels, just like everybody else does. No, I don't do drugs. No, I've never done drugs. No, I don't have an eating disorder. No, I don't have an addiction problem, right? But let me tell you, I can ruminate like a banshee, and it's not always good for me. And I can focus on things that aren't really that important and drive myself and everybody else around me nuts doing it. So, you know, one pathology is not greater than another. You know, there is no quote-unquote sin of pathology that's a greater sin than something else, okay? They're all equally pretty annoying and pretty life-impacting. So the bottom line message of this is you've got to learn to control yourself. You've got to learn to get a handle on what you do, right? And that requires analyzing your thought processes, because all of this comes out of your brain, analyzing the environmental stuff that encourages you to have dysfunctional thought processes, right, and the people around you that can cause you to have dysfunctional, encourage you to go back into bad ideas and bad habits, right? And that's why one of the other things that the 12-step organizations and I agree on, you know, one of the things in the so-called big book, you know, is that you want to avoid people, places, and things and encourage you to use. Well, that's just really good behavior management, okay? Because if you use substances around certain kinds of folks or in certain kinds of environments, you have to avoid those folks and those environments like the plague, particularly in the early stages. Most people, if they're going to relapse on a drug, if they're going to, you know, have an episode where they reuse the drug, it's going to happen. You know, the first 6 months are the most dangerous, and the first 2 years in general are the most dangerous. The first 6 months to a year are really, really dangerous, right? Because you're trying to uncondition, unlearn the association you have, and so it is of paramount importance that you limit your exposure to people, places, and things that encourage you to use. So if you like good Reuben sandwiches, but the best place in town that makes Reubens that you like is Joe's Bar and Grill, you're going to have to just settle for a slightly less good tasting Reuben. right? Or send your coworker in to buy the Reuben with no beers and bring it to you at your desk and eat lunch at the office, okay, or at school. Don't do it. You're not going to be able to resist it in the first, you know, I shouldn't say that. In all likelihood, if you follow the traditional trajectory of so-called recovery, you're not, you know, your chances of resisting the temptation are extremely low. Don't do it. There's no need to do it. You're being stupid about it. You're not using setting events and environmental management correctly. And those are the things that are going to start your thought process chain through the classical conditioning paradigm we talked about, Pavlov's dog. You know, and what's really frightening about the Pavlov thing is Mick Jagger knows more about Pavlov than the average individual. If you don't believe me, listen to the lyrics of the Rolling Stones song Bitch, which is the first song on the second side if you have the old record, the actual physical record. Most people never seen one. It's the first song on the second side of the recording. Or on the CD, it's like the sixth or seventh song. You know, it's the da 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 da. Right, that's the song Bitch. Well, the chorus of that is, when you call my name, I salivate like a Pavlov's dog. Okay, it's kind of amazing, isn't it? Mick Jagger knowing something about Pavlovian conditioning. That's a little frightening, isn't it? Anyway, don't be a Pavlov's dog. Right, limit your exposure to the meat powder or the experimenter who gives you the meat powder, right? And I often hear people go, oh, I know I have to make a whole new set of friends. Well, yes, I'm sorry, you do. If you want to remain sober, you do. I'm sorry. That's just the nature. You know, I'm not God. I didn't create the universe. I didn't make the behavioral rules. I can't change them. I am the guy that can tell you what they are and tell you how to avoid being a victim of them. And instead of being a victim, be the author of the new you. And that's really what this is about, okay? This is about you taking charge and making different life choices and empowering yourself. Take the power back. Take charge of your life back. Stop giving it away to substances or people or places or things because you're worth more than that. Don't do it. It's stupid as hell. Okay, and it's not going to get you anywhere where you really want to go ultimately. I often use the phrase short-term gains, and I use the term gains in quotes. In other words, I feel better because I just smoked, you know, a pound of weed, so I'm not as nervous and stressed out as I was 20 minutes ago, right? Short-term gains for long-term pains. Okay, and that's what we're talking about with substance use, right? You feel better in the short run, but in the long run, you're setting up bad behavioral patterns. And if you're already in the pattern, you already have a dependency issue, you're setting yourself up, you've already relapsed, and you're setting yourself up for future relapses and stupid behavior while you're intoxicated under the influence, okay? Bad idea. Bad, 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 bad idea. So I'm going to close this podcast out, and we'll have one more podcast talking about some treatment methods and what to do and how to do it. And some do's and don'ts, and you know, how you can maximize your success rate with this kind of thing. It is really tricky, particularly if you have, as I've mentioned before, several substance dependence disorders comorbidly, which most people do, and if you have a boatload of psychological issues, which most people do, on top of the substance use disorders, because as I've said before, nobody came out of the chute being an addict. Oh, why do you drink? Because I'm an alcoholic. Well, how'd you become an alcoholic? Because I drink. Well, I'm sorry, that's stupid circular reasoning. No, you drink because you want to feel better because of something. You got to find out what that something is. You got to find out what your thought patterns are, and you've got to change those things. Because if you don't, you're just going to go from one thing to the next thing to the next thing. And maybe you won't be an alcoholic anymore, but you'll go to something else that will be used as symptom substitution for the thing that you're trying to modify, and you just need to get at the core and deal with it once and for all and be done with it. You know, kind of like cutting the root of the cancer out, getting rid of the damn thing so you don't have to deal with it again. Okay, have a good one, and I'll talk to you guys later. Thanks so much for listening, and I hope you guys have an awesome day.